Chapter 11, Progress and Poverty. Chapter Preview, People. Francis Warrington Dawson, Samuel F. B. Morse, Cornelius Vanderbilt, John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, Thomas G. Clemson. Places: Conway, Greenville, Aiken, Somerville, Bennettsville, Darlington, Phoenix. Terms: Lynching, Industrial Revolution, Capitalist, Yellow Journalism, Deflation, Gold Standard, Textiles, Redeemers, Bourbons, Disfranchise, Conflict Lease System, Populism, Land Grants, Dispensary, Prohibition, Poll Tax, Segregation, Jim Crow System. Francis Warrington Dawson was an unlikely and unusual South Carolinian. He was born in London, England, and came to America on a Southern blockade runner in 1862 to fight for the Confederacy. He fought in 11 battles, was wounded 3 times, and was captured by Union troops. After the war, Dawson came to Charleston to work as a newspaperman. He and a partner bought the Charleston News, then the Charleston Courier, and merged the two. Dawson made the News and Courier a true news-gathering organization, having correspondents in Charleston, Columbia, and Washington, D.C. Its daily editions, shipped by railroad, covered the Palmetto State. The News and Dawson's editorials made the News and Courier the premier paper in the state, a powerful voice for progress. Often his editorials were unpopular and courageous. They challenged Carolinians to make improvements in their society. Dawson campaigned for a new South, built on more industry, diversified agriculture, and better education. He helped lead a successful campaign to outlaw dueling. The devout Roman Catholic's anti-dueling editorials won him a high honor from the Pope. Although challenged to many duels, he never accepted. He also wrote vigorously, but less successfully, against lynching, the killing of a suspect without a trial, usually by mob action. This crusader against violence in society became a victim of violence in 1889. Dawson was convinced his doctor was making improper advances on the Dawson children's governess. He confronted the doctor about it, and the doctor shot him dead. Claiming self-defense, the doctor was acquitted by the jury. Dawson was one of the few foreigners in South Carolina in this era. He was a romantic about the Confederate cause and generally supported the white establishment of the state. But his outside perspective helped him see faults in his adopted society and crusade for improvements. Section 1. The National Industrial Boom. As you read, look for factors that led to the growth of railroads and to new industries. How American natural resources and creativity produced great inventions. The role of government in the success of big business. How American prosperity encouraged increased immigration. The beginning of an American empire. Terms: Industrial Revolution, Capitalist, Yellow Journalism. An industrial revolution is a shift of an economy from an agricultural base to a dependence primarily on manufacturing. With the use of machinery powered by water or steam, or later, electricity. Revolution is not always an accurate term for the shift from farm to factory because it was often a long, gradual process, more an evolution than a revolution. The world's first industrial revolution began in Britain in the mid-18th century and accelerated and spread in the 19th century. The United States had some industrial development before 1860, mostly in the Northeast, but her great boom came in the post-Civil War decades. The rise of big business. The development of great industries and transportation systems would transform American life and cause the United States to become one of the world's most powerful nations by 1900. the South, because of the destruction of the Civil War and disruption of Reconstruction, was left behind in this new economy. The total industrial output of all the Southern states combined in 1890 was equal to one-half that of New York State. The railroads. The first really big businesses to develop in the United States were the railroads. They were the very symbols of power, movement, and flexibility. They could go where rivers and canals could not, across the dry plains, through mountains, right up to factory loading platforms. Their operations were often spread across several states with thousands of employees. New techniques of organization and communication were necessary. The telegraph, invented in the 1840s by Samuel F. B. Morse, was essential to the development of railroads. They needed exact timing and communication of train locations. The railroads collaborated by establishing standard time zones in 1883. They set up four zones across the nation, with the time for each zone standardized to match sun time near its center. Before that, each community had its own time. For example, before 1883, when it was noon in Columbia, it was 12:04 in Charleston and 12:16 in Washington, D.C. This had made it hard to schedule trains accurately. The railroads also agreed to adopt one standard width between the two rails, so cars could continue to travel on another company's rails without having to unload and reload the cargo. All the tracks in America were adjusted to the new standard on one day in 1886. These changes contributed to efficiency through standardization. Captains of industry, some less kindly called them robber barons, also sought efficiency and profits through consolidation of rail lines. Men such as Cornelius Vanderbilt, J. Edgar Thomson, and Thomas A. Scott built transportation empires and became very wealthy in an era before income taxes were imposed. At the end of the Civil War, America had 35,000 miles of track. By 1900, it had 193,000 miles of track, more than on the whole continent of Europe. The Northeast was thickly laced with tracks, and that network was connected to the Pacific coast by the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad in 1869. The South's railroads grew only more slowly. Oil and steel. Other big businesses were oil and steel. John D. Rockefeller managed to get control of most of the oil production in the country. His Standard Oil Company was nearly a monopoly. Andrew Carnegie did much the same thing in the steel industry. He used the new Bessemer process developed in Britain, which made mass production of steel practical and reasonable in price. Steel was probably the single most important factor in the industrialization process. Steel was the main ingredient in rails and locomotives, most machinery, bridges, and the skyscrapers that were being built in large cities. Natural, human, and government resources. America's rapid rise to industrial leadership in the world was made possible by abundant natural resources, but it also resulted from the great inventiveness of the American people. American inventors produced the typewriter, 1867, the telephone, 1876, the cash register, 1879, and the adding machine, 1888. By the 1870s, the United States had laid undersea cables that connected our telegraph network with those of Europe, Japan, China, and Brazil. Inventors discovered ways to make electricity do astounding things. It could light up a city, run trolleys and subways, zoom elevators to the top of skyscrapers, and, by the end of the century, power great factories. Another factor in the rapid industrialization of the United States was the active assistance of the federal, state, and local governments. Government fostered and subsidized, supported, business development. The federal government gave large cash grants, plus huge tracts of land in the west, to get railroads to build lines through thinly populated territories and over difficult terrain. State and local governments gave tax breaks to encourage railroads to build in their areas. The national government imposed tariffs on foreign-made goods to make them more expensive than American-made goods. Tariffs were good for American businesses, but they drove up prices for American consumers. Finally, the government helped business by imposing very few rules that would enforce safe working conditions or prevent pollution of the environment. Industrial slowdowns, depressions. Industrial progress and economic development were not always smooth. Occasionally, there were economic slowdowns, such as the Depression in 1873. A second major depression began in 1893. Each economic collapse caused great suffering. Unemployed people could get no help from the government in the 19th century. Most politicians and businessmen thought that the government should allow the economy to operate without intervention. According to the 18th century theory of laissez-faire, which means let it alone, the economy would operate on its own, and in the long run, everyone's needs would be met. The irony is that the government was willing to intervene sometimes to help business, but not to help individuals who might lose their jobs or be hurt on the job. Efforts at forming labor unions to promote laborers' interests and rights usually had little long-term success. Calls for reforms to improve conditions for workers and for poor citizens of crowded industrial cities were not yet heeded. Prosperity and immigration. In spite of depressions and labor-employer conflicts, the main theme in the nation as a whole from the 1870s to 1900 was progress and a higher standard of living for most Americans. The promise of a better life in America attracted millions of immigrants from Europe and other continents. In the American West, the federal government was giving out land, 160 acres per family, and it was free. It's hard to imagine being a peasant in Europe, where all the land had been taken up for centuries, learning about a country where land was being given away to anyone who would come and settle. Those who came to America on that promise probably never reached the western frontier. Most immigrants settled into crowded and dirty cities, but there were usually jobs of some sort to be had, and some immigrants would emerge into good jobs and would become prosperous middle-class Americans. There were even a few immigrants, like Andrew Carnegie, who became extraordinarily wealthy. The American dream was very much alive. Popular novels by American writer Horatio Alger taught the young that if they worked hard, were morally good, and had a little bit of luck, they could become rich. Prosperity and empire. By the 1890s, the nation was exporting more goods than it imported. America was becoming wealthy. Ever since Jamestown, Plymouth, and Charlestown, Americans had been expanding westward. Now the people began to look abroad for new markets for their goods and new places for capitalists, those who invest in businesses and run them for profit, to invest their money. Remnants of the old Spanish Empire, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, looked inviting, and the Spanish treatment of their island subjects gave Americans a moral justification for intervention. The Spanish-American War. When the Cubans rebelled against Spain in 1895, the Spaniards forced Cuban citizens into concentration camps where thousands died. Americans were sickened by the news, which was reported in a very emotional manner by the new yellow journalism, a type of journalism that uses sensational reporting and crusades against corruption and injustice. Big city papers called for American intervention against Spain. In February 1898, the United States sent the battleship Maine to Havana Harbor in a show of power and an effort to protect Americans in Cuba if necessary. A few days later, the Maine blew up and sank. Convinced that the Spanish were responsible, the United States declared war in April 1898. Spain had become a weak nation, and the United States won the war in 10 weeks. The volunteers from South Carolina did not even get to a battlefield, so the state was little affected by the war, but America was greatly affected. An American Empire. The Spanish-American War of 1898 represented America's arrival on the world stage as a great power, a new world empire with foreign territorial possessions outside North America. Spain transferred to the United States by treaty Puerto Rico in the Caribbean and Guam and the Philippines in the Pacific. Cuba was to be independent, but America held a supervisory role there for several decades with American soldiers on the island. We also got permanent use of a naval base at a place called Guantanamo. In the mood of expansion, the nation annexed Hawaii at the request of American sugar plantation owners who had overthrown the Hawaiian queen and set up a republic. Now America owned one of the finest harbors in the Pacific, Pearl Harbor. America also acquired the islands that came to be called American Samoa. Hawaii and Samoa gave the American Navy and our merchants coaling stations for refueling their ships. The harbors made trade and the exercise of power in the Pacific much easier. America was engaging in imperialism, increasing a nation's power by gaining control over other countries, as the British, French, and Spanish had earlier. Americans justified all the acquisitions as being necessary for the economic growth and welfare of the nation's businesses. Many Americans also believed that, along with the British Empire, America must help govern, teach, and civilize the world. America was by 1900 wealthy and a rising world power. In a little more than a century, the country expanded from the Atlantic coast to the West Coast and into the Pacific. However, South Carolina, one of the wealthiest of the 13 original states, had seen her wealth and power swept away, and the state struggled through the final decades of the century as one of the poorest and least powerful sections of the nation. Do you remember? 1. Define in sentence form, Industrial Revolution, Capitalist, Yellow Journalism. 2. Why was the South left behind in the nation's post-Civil War economy? 3. What advantages did the annexation of Hawaii and American Samoa give to the United States?